Welcome to North Star Church. At North Star, our desire is to lead people to follow Jesus Christ and not simply go to church, but to be the church. The following message was recorded and produced at our Blacksburg, Virginia campus. You can find more information about North Star, including recent podcasts, news, upcoming events, and so much more at northstarfamily.org. Thanks for listening, and we hope you enjoyed today's message.
Well, this morning we will be continuing in our series in the book of James. So if you want to turn to James chapter 5, we've now reached the last chapter of James. Maybe you're excited about that, or maybe you're not, but today we're going to be in verses 1 through 6. And while you're flipping there, I want to ask you, have you ever been caught red-handed? Maybe the last time was when you were stealing cookies out of the cookie jar, or maybe you were like one of those dog food people. You ate dog food as a kid? Anybody do that? Yeah, that was me. I'm sorry. I was caught red-handed doing that one time. But maybe it's people watching for you. Maybe you've caught eye contact with somebody, and you're like, oh, man, I didn't think they knew I was watching them. Just this weekend, Adeline bought some Starburst jelly beans for Easter, and I think they were supposed to make it until Easter. I thought that I hid what I did really well, but then she took one whiff and said, how did you like the jelly beans? So getting caught red-handed, it happens. It can be embarrassing. It can be funny sometimes, but sometimes it's painful. Something might come to mind for you of what that looks like. But in 2009, there was a bank robber that this came in really true for. It was very painful to be caught red-handed. He went in to a bank, robbed it, and said, hey, give me all the money. He got away with so much money that he had to stuff some of it down his pants to get out. And so he was making his getaway, but little did he know was that the teller had stuffed some exploding red dye packs inside of the bills. And so as soon as he left the bank, all of those exploding dye packs went off in his pants. That meant that he had some second-degree burns, ouch, but also that everything that he had was stained with red. Needless to say, this was probably the police's very easiest chase. They could tell who it was that had robbed the bank and had shoved money down his pants. Then they took him to the hospital. So the story ends well. But as we turn to our passage today, James's words are kind of like a spiritual dye pack. They're explosive. They leave an unquestionable mark. He's going to be calling out this morning against the rich who have been misusing their wealth, not stewarding it for God's purposes, and instead robbing God of what he has given them. And so there's this really stunning and stark rebuke. And so as we look at these verses, let's read them, but then also consider how should it guide our response this morning. Read with me. Verses 1 through 6 in chapter 5. James says, come now, you rich people, weep and wail over the miseries that are coming on you. Your wealth has rotted, and your clothes are moth-eaten. Your gold and silver are corroded, and their corrosion will be a witness against you and will eat your flesh like fire. You have stored up treasure in the last days. Look, the pay that you withheld from the workers who mowed your fields cries out, and the outcry of the harvesters has reached the ears of the Lord of armies. You have lived luxuriously on the earth and have indulged yourselves. You have fattened your hearts in a day of slaughter. You have condemned, you have murdered the righteous who does not resist you. This is God's word. In this passage, James points out what being mastered by wealth looks like. He says that the pursuit and the love of wealth is like a spiritual snare that if we leave it unchecked will lead to destruction. So as we try to apply and interpret this passage this morning, the important question is, who are these rich people? Let's first get that down. Why does he so harshly call them out? And then what can we take from that? So who are these people? Well, from the context that we get from James' letter, we infer that these are wealthy landowners throughout the Roman Empire that built their prosperity on farming and business and trade, and they had some kind of intersection with the church. Now, they would either get to their position by being in the right family or by building wealth themselves. And so to secure their high status, they would employ people and then kind of make them dependent on them for survival. And so it's very likely that some of these people in the church were employed as day laborers by these rich landowners. And so they would get there, and then the landowners would manipulate them into staying so they couldn't leave. And so in their hunger for wealth, the rich often became corrupt in their business dealings. They would take control of other people, and they would accrue an abundance of possessions to form their status in front of others. And so to be clear, as we read the rich, James is not condemning them simply for having wealth. The Bible has multiple examples throughout the Old and the New Testament of faithful stewards and faithful servants of Jesus that have wealth but use it to bless others. And so God's word is not so concerned about us possessing wealth, but wealth possessing us. You see the difference there? The problem is not that they had means, but instead they had idolized wealth to the point where they would step on others and dishonor God to get it. And so now they're guilty. Well, why are they guilty? Well, the Bible makes clear that wealth is given to us as a responsibility to be stewarded. God owns everything. All things are made for him, but he entrusts us with certain privileges to be able to steward towards that end. He invites us to join him in his mission. That's a really incredible thing. But it means that wealth is a responsibility. And because of that, we're also going to be held accountable for how we use the wealth he's given us. And so these rich have not used it in the way that God has intended. Now, when we come to these words, weep and wail, it sounds like pretty harsh. And so commentators are really divided. You could read 100 different commentaries. 50 of them would say these are Christians, and 50 of them would say that it's not. And so it's worth thinking about, how do we respond based on where we are in our walks with Jesus to this? Because it sounds like James is issuing condemnation. So if they are Christians, it means that they could have, in a time of persecution, turned to some of these strategies to make sure that they stayed ahead. And so they were maybe oppressing some people, even in their own congregation. That would make sense if James is addressing people in this letter directly the whole rest of the time. Why wouldn't they be in the hearing of this letter? And so it's possible. We see in James 2 that both the poor and the rich people might be in their assembly. And we know that it was a temptation for some of the members of the congregation to envy the wealthy. So that is possible. But what seems more likely is that James is using this as an example to caution and to comfort the congregation. This interpretation would say that these are non-believers that aren't necessarily going to hear this letter spoken, but like a prophet, James is calling out against their wickedness and pronouncing God's judgment on them. He's not holding out a call for repentance because these are people that are not repentant. And so weeping and wailing is because judgment day is coming and there's no hope. We see an example of this all throughout the prophets, but in Isaiah 13, one example is Isaiah calls out against Babylon and their fate on the day of the Lord. In verse 6, he says, "Wail, for the day of the Lord is near. As destruction from the Almighty, it will come." So even though Babylon wasn't in the room, right, he didn't fly them in to be able to tell them, hey, here's what's coming. This was a pronouncement of God's judgment on unrighteousness. And that had a couple of functions. It expressed God's will, but also it was a byword for Judah. Judah had started turning towards some of these things. And so Isaiah is saying, watch out. If you go down this path, this is what will be your end. And so James is doing the same. And then next week, we're going to see that is also used for comforting God's people. To the rich, this is really bad news. But to the poor, to those who had been oppressed, this was good news that God was going to call those who oppressed them to account. So, to sum it up, I think a useful way to see these verses is as a condemnation of the rich that are mastered by wealth, that put their trust in something other than Jesus. He's using this condemnation of that lifestyle to caution those who are tempted to imitate the rich in their stewardship and invite reflection and then comfort those who are oppressed. So this morning, we're going to be focusing on the caution. Now, it can be tempting to kind of write this off and picture the superhero villain that has all the wealth in the world and say, that's who James is talking about, right? You picture Lex Luthor or something like that. Somebody who has all this wealth and is corrupt. But James says, watch out. This is more meant to be a mirror than it is to point to somebody else. And so as we hear these words, think about where might I see some signs of this attitude towards wealth in my life? So, as we look at this, remember that James has been urging us to examine the character and quality of our faith through examining our works. And so this morning should be no different. Consider where God might be revealing areas of divided devotion. And our response, whether we are repentant or we harden to it, is going to say a lot about us. So, what does this life of misusing wealth look like? Well, James makes kind of a court case, and he uses four pieces of evidence to indict them. So, Exhibit 1, verses 2 through 3, says that your wealth has rotted, and your clothes are moth-eaten. Your gold and silver are corroded, and their corrosion will be a witness against you and will eat your flesh like fire. You have stored up treasure in the last days. So we see that the first hallmark of misplaced wealth is that the rich have hoarded their resources. Now, in the ancient world, there were a lot of ways to tell if you were wealthy, but three of the main ways were how much grain you had, what clothes you had, and then also what precious metals you had. And so if you had a lot of those, it also meant that you had some security, some prestige in the world. And so a lot of commentators think that when he says wealth and pictures it rotting, he's talking to these stores of grain. If you were here last week, we looked at the parable of the rich fool. And Jeff talked to us about when Jesus pictures this man who has stored up all this grain in his barns, and then his life is taken from him. James gives a similar picture here. These rich landowners had stored up grain because they thought, if I store up enough, I'm never going to have to worry about food or money again. Right? If you had enough, you wouldn't have to worry about famine. And if famine did come, you could sell off what you had to make a profit. And so, really, grain started becoming security for you. We see in Genesis that Joseph advises Pharaoh to store up grain. And it actually leads to blessing others when famine hits. So James isn't calling out against saving things. You should save. Save out of an abundance. But that's not what was happening here. Instead, they were storing up heaps of wealth as their source of financial and physical security. If you had enough nice clothes, then you could maintain that you were somebody for a long time. If you had enough gold and silver, then their value wouldn't fluctuate over time, and you would be set for life. But James says there's a problem. They don't last. They've stored up so much grain that it's gone bad, and it's spoiled all that they had in the barn. They can't use it to help their communities. They can't use it for profit. It's worthless. They've stored up so many clothes in their closet that now it just feeds moths. It's not worth anything anymore. The moth will eat it and then fly into a candle and die. Even their gold and silver are corroded. And gold doesn't corrode, but James says that is how transient and unstable these things are. And so in the judgment, these things don't stand, but also right now in their present life, it affects their souls. Their failure to steward their wealth has crippled their generosity, right? All of these images are these stores of wealth sitting unused that could be and should be used to benefit others. And so in some translations of the Bible, this person is called a miser. You might have heard of a miser. But it's somebody who basically has wealth, but is so stingy and unwilling to share it because they think that if they give anything away, then that's giving part of their security away. And so in the New King James Version, Proverbs 23, 6 through 8 says, "Do not eat the bread of a miser, nor desire his delicacies, for as he thinks in his heart, so is he. Eat and drink, he says to you, but his heart is not with you. The morsel you have eaten, you will vomit up and waste your pleasant words." He says, go ahead, eat whatever you want. Yeah, I'll be generous. But really, he's watching every bite you take. Mentally, he's pulling it back out and wanting to store it away. You might know somebody like that. That somebody might be you. When you have an opportunity, are you more excited to store your wealth or to share it? Miser and miserable come from the same root word. Is your life governed by this miserable devotion to storing things up? Are your figures dictated by faith or are they controlled by fear? See, the truth is that trusting in wealth leads us to fearfully seek security and identity in things that aren't going to last or satisfy. As your riches go, so will you. What you build your life on now is going to be evidence when you give an account to God at the end. James says that in verse 3. He says, their corrosion, your misuse of these things will be a witness against you and will eat your flesh like fire. The very things that they used as evidence of their prestige and their wealth are going to be the same things that show they didn't do what they were called to do. It's scary. So, where is your security this morning? Is it found in trusting that God will provide for your needs and for joyful generosity? Or is it in squirreling away enough until you feel comfortable? So then James moves on to exhibit 2. He says in verse 4, "Look, the pay that you withheld from the workers who mowed your fields cries out, and the outcry of the harvesters has reached the ears of the Lord of armies." Not only have the rich misused their wealth by hoarding it, but they've gained it by fraud. Instead of fairly and promptly paying the people that have actually gained their wealth for them by working for them, they've held back. They said, "I'll maybe pay you tomorrow. I'll hold back your paycheck." Now, there's a difference between delayed payment being innocent and malicious. I've now been the best man for 2 weddings, and getting groomsmen to remember to pay for things is very difficult. We'll just say I've learned to pay for things out of savings when I go on a trip, because I know it might take 50 reminders to say, "Hey, man, you remember, that trip we went on? Yeah, you haven't paid for it, and now I'm broke." That's usually pretty innocent, right? It's somebody forgot, or maybe, hey, I don't have the cash. That's fine, but that's not what's happening here. Sometimes we feel this urge and we feel like we're justified in being a little bit loose with our money because we think it's a victimless crime. Right? Pirating a movie or stealing somebody else's login, that's not going to hurt the big corporations, right? That's no big deal. I can not pay for anything if I just bum off of everybody else. Might be a little inconvenient when somebody else is logged out of their account, but it's fine. It's not going to hurt the billionaires. Maybe you're looking for something to be done around your house, and so you want to hire somebody around the church, not because you want to support their business, but because you know they're going to get it cheaper. Or you can kind of bully them into doing it for free because they won't call you on it. And so we start to think, wow, how nice would it be to get things done around here if there's somebody that wasn't going to challenge me on paying them fairly? It's tax season. If you haven't done them yet, like me, you should. But there's always a temptation to embellish just a little bit. Say, man, I'm seeing that number climb a little bit on my refund. It'd be really nice to get just a bit more for that vacation. And who's going to audit me? Really, am I going to get audited? That is the thinking of the rich. It's no big deal. Nobody's going to catch me. But God's word makes clear that it is a big deal. In the Old Testament, God makes a provision for the poor laborer in the law. In Deuteronomy 24, he says, "Do not oppress a hired worker who is poor and needy, whether one of your Israelite brothers or one of the resident aliens in a town in your land. You are to pay him his wages each day before the sun sets, because he is poor and he depends on them. Otherwise, he will cry out to the Lord against you, and you will be held guilty." This wasn't a small deal. Neglecting their duty to serve themselves instead meant that the day laborers that counted on that paycheck were left without food. It meant ruin and death because they didn't steward well. And God says, this isn't going to be swept under the rug. There's an audit coming. It says that this cry from the wages and from the laborers, everything that they've done in private and in public, those cries have reached the Lord of armies, and he will act. God is not fooled. He's kept a perfect record of their lack of stewardship. He's bringing an eschatological audit. God knows all, and he will judge with perfect justice on the behalf of the oppressed. So what do you let slide because you assume you'll get away with it? What do you justify because nobody has caught you yet, or that you don't feel like it's a big deal? Maybe there's financial deception in your life. Maybe there's somebody or something that you've taken advantage of to gain more for yourself, and you haven't really cared what it did to them as long as you got more. While it might feel like little things, it affects others and your own soul immensely. If you have influence over others, there's great reward in being found faithful with financial integrity. But we can also so quickly enter dangerous territory if we forget that what we have is a gift from God and we have a responsibility. So then we move on to our third piece of evidence. It reaches a climax here in verse 5. He says, "You have lived luxuriously on the earth and have indulged yourselves. You have fattened your hearts in a day of slaughter." All of the riches, deceptive gain, and selfish hoarding are matched in their self-indulgence with spending. This word luxuriously communicates this kind of softness of life that pursues comfort and satisfaction. And though that might seem like something that's foreign, our culture is pretty obsessed with comfort. It highly values comfort and self-care. The wellness and self-care industry has skyrocketed to being over $500 billion in value annually. And that number climbs day by day. Marketers have started to sell products, not by telling you what a product actually does, but how it makes you feel. You're not sold insurance, you're sold being in good hands or having a good neighbor that's there for you. Red Bull doesn't give you heart problems, it gives you wings, right? Emotional appeals are what get us. That need for comfort, that need for security, that want for pleasure. And while taking care of our mental and physical needs is important, and God's gifts are meant to be enjoyed, we can very quickly go from living lives focused outwardly to looking hopelessly inward. James compares being self-indulgent instead of a steward to an animal fattening itself for slaughter. When we moved as a family in high school, we met some of our neighbors down the road, and we were kind of in the middle of nowhere, and so part of the tour was going out to where their animals were, which seems like a really interesting thing to do before you go in the house, but that was how it went. And in the back corner was a pig, and his name was Pig. Should have been a hint for what's coming. But Pig had everything that you could ever want. Pig had all the food in the world. He had a really nice pen. He had a really nice place to lay down. Pig was living the life. And over the last couple of weeks, Pig had been getting everything that he wanted more and more. And so Pig was big. He was happy. Pig was living the life. And if he heard, I don't know if he can understand English, but he might have heard that there was a feast coming at the end of the week. And so Pig might have been thinking, man, this is awesome. I can't wait for the feast. I'm going to get to gorge myself even more. Well, the next day, the feast did come. Our neighbors came. They had some homemade cookies. And Pig was invited. But he didn't know he was going to be on the plate. Poor Pig. I say that to say that in the same way, we can be so focused on consuming, pursuing our own pleasure and wealth, that we fail to remember that we are temporary stewards and not owners. Our daily bread is not meant to fatten us for idleness, but to fill us for God's service. And so we can get so comfortable that we lose sight of our purpose, and we can lose sight of eternity. We can live as if nothing is ever going to change. And so it is very possible this morning that you can go your whole life stepping on others, indulging your every desire, filling your house with everything that you could ever want, and then get to the end of your life and realize you've wasted it. When we give into self-indulgence, we reveal that we don't believe that what God has in store for us is better. It's all about us. Become so consumed that we forget that the abundant life Jesus calls us to is one of denying ourselves. Jesus says in Matthew 16, says, if anyone wants to follow after me, let him deny himself, take up his cross, and follow me. For whoever wants to save his life will lose it. But whoever loses his life because of me will find it. For what will it benefit someone if he gains the whole world yet loses his life? Or what will anyone give in exchange for his life? For the Son of Man is going to come with his angels in the glory of his Father. And then he will reward each according to what he has done. Where are you looking for your reward? Now? You want all the pleasure now, or do you want it now and in the life to come? Life with Jesus will cause us to die to our old selves and to our selfish desires. But he promises that the abundant life he gives us now and forever is full of reward. Do you believe that there's faithfulness, that there is reward in faithfulness to Jesus now? And if not, what are you struggling to believe about the gospel that might be hindering you from experiencing the abundant life that he promised? Finally, there seems to be a progression. We get to verse 6. James lays out his final piece of evidence. He says, "You have condemned, you have murdered the righteous who does not resist you." James says that living a life controlled by wealth leads our hearts to becoming so distorted that we do anything to get it. Not only do the rich deprive their workers of their wages, but they don't care. They don't care that they're cutting off others' livelihoods to have their own extravagance. And they don't have any reason to do this. It's not like the poor have done something wrong. They haven't even fought them. Instead, they have remained righteous, while the wicked have persevered in their wickedness. It's a terrifying thought to think that we got from just hoarding things to murder. What started out maybe just as a little lying here or there, or taking advantage of somebody and pursuing some comfort, has now turned into murdering the poor. We see now we're at a complete reversal of what wealth is meant for. Instead of it being used to bring blessing in life, it's bringing death. So if we don't check our hearts, as Matt was talking about, if we don't examine the mold that might be growing behind our walls, eventually we might find ourselves so numbed that we'll do whatever we can to get wealth, things we didn't even think was possible, without even realizing it. If we don't surrender it to God, we'll find that it's killing us and others. And so in preparation for this sermon, I read The Giving Tree again. It's really sweet. But as I read it again, I was like, well, not really. Kind of took issue with some of the things. And it is sweet. As a parent now, I see like, wow, I'm going to give and give, and I'm going to love it, and then, you know, I might not see it in return, all that. But as we read it again from the perspective of the boy, it's kind of troubling. He starts off enjoying the tree, and the tree loves giving him things. And so he plays in the tree, he picks its apples, he climbs in its branches, and it says the tree was happy, and the boy was too. But then years pass. The boy gets older. He doesn't want a relationship with the tree. The tree says, come play, come play. He says, I don't have time for that. I want money. Can you give me something to sell? So the tree says, yeah, I'll give you some apples. Go ahead, please, go make money. I would love for you to be happy. So he rejects the relationship so he can go make money. Years later, walks back in as a man to the forest. The tree is so happy. He isn't there to play. He says, I need a family and a house. I need a house. Give me a house. And so he chops the branches off the tree to make a house. And then eventually, after years of just standing as a trunk, the man comes back to the tree and says, I want to get away from it all. I just want to enjoy myself as an old man. So the tree says, okay, take my trunk. He makes a boat and sails away. At the end, the tree has nothing left. It's just a stump. It says the tree was happy, but not really. Think about that for a second. After being exploited its whole life, even to the point of death, though, it's still bent on being benevolent. The boy walks in as an old man now. And the tree says, I'm sorry, I can't give you anything. I don't have anything more to give. And the boy doesn't say, I'm so sorry. I destroyed you for my own pleasure. Doesn't say it was childish of me to think that my desires were okay to just chop you down for. Instead, he says, okay, that's fine. I just need a place to sit. So I'm just going to sit on you. It makes you cry, right? But also, he's kind of a jerk. It's kind of apt that they still call him a boy because he never grows up, even when he's old. He's never satisfied. And he doesn't care at all that he's absolutely destroyed this tree that loves him. He never has any problem using the tree for his needs, even though he destroys it. How often is that us? With others, with God. How often do we say, I don't want a relationship, I just want you to give me things? So, in response to all these things, what do we do? How can we hear this and actually change? Well, we need more than just new financial principles, we need new hearts. You will not be free from the mastery of wealth until you truly understand and receive the one who willingly laid his life down and became poor to make you rich. The gospel is that while we were still running from God with this red dye staining our hands from robbing God and misusing the things that he entrusted to us, Jesus stepped down from heaven's riches and became poor for us. His spiritual audit was clean. But on the cross, he laid his life down for the very people that condemned him for 30 pieces of silver, so that they could maintain their power. Jesus took our condemnation upon himself. He fully paid the debt we owed. And 3 days later, he arose with a receipt. It had been paid for. The resurrection was the receipt that our debt has been paid fully. And so, in return for our guilt, he offers his perfect righteousness to be received by faith. He takes our stains so we can be spotless. And so now, for those who put their faith in Jesus, we no longer have to fear condemnation because the day of slaughter has come. And Jesus took our place. We're secure because of Jesus' work. We're secure and we can be corrected because of Jesus' work. And we can look forward to his return, not as a day where we have to fear, but instead as a day where we get to await our reward. I'll just read from Luke 12 really quick as we wrap up. Last week, Jeff landed us at Matthew 6:33. He said that the cure to worrying and presumption is when Jesus says, seek first the kingdom of God and his righteousness. All these things will be provided for you. For people that were worried about money and seeking security and storing up things for themselves, Jesus says, seek first the kingdom. And where this is recorded in Luke's gospel account, he speaks these beautiful words right after. He says, don't be afraid, little flock, because your Father delights to give you the kingdom. Sell your possessions and give to the poor. God is not stingy. He's not like us. He delights to give us good gifts, and he will. He's our Father. Sell your possessions and give to the poor. Make money bags for yourselves that won't grow old. An inexhaustible treasure in heaven, where no thief comes near and no moth destroys. For where your treasure is, there your heart will be also. Do you want that indestructible treasure? Where you find your treasure is where you'll find your heart. Where is it? I'll go ahead and invite the worship team back up as we wrap up. And as we do, how might we respond this morning? Well, there are a couple of different ways, but first and foremost, if you have placed your hope and security in wealth and haven't trusted in Jesus, James is clear that there is no lasting hope outside of Jesus. Wealth is going to fail you. It's not going to be able to pay what you owe. It's not going to satisfy. So if you've never trusted in Jesus by faith this morning, you can. You can turn from your sin. Surrender it to God and receive his forgiveness and cleansing by trusting in Jesus alone. Maybe your faith is in Jesus, but you've been convicted this morning that there are some areas that you might need to grow in. Weep and wail, not as somebody who's condemned, but as somebody who's being corrected. And ask God to help you in those areas. I've got just a couple of little bullet points of some things that could be helpful that I was thinking through, of ways that you could practically see this in your week this week. The first, maybe revisit your budget through the lens of being a steward of God's wealth. Where might your generosity change? And what might your saving and spending reflect if you viewed your wealth as something to steward? Then, if you're like me, maybe you have a plan, or maybe you have personal debts. Maybe it's something you haven't paid somebody back for, and you have the ability to. Make a plan to do it, and then do it. Maybe it's just a small step like that. Or maybe it's writing a handwritten thank you note to someone who's generously provided for you. Instead of being somebody who is consumed by consuming, cultivate generosity and gratitude. It will shape your heart in a cool way. And then keep a journal of God's generosity. Remind yourself that he delights to give you the kingdom, and that he continues to provide for you. And then meditate and memorize Luke 12, 29 through 34. Commit those words to your heart and let it shape your stance towards wealth.
We're so glad you found this message today. You can find more resources, including previous podcasts, at northstarfamily.org. Thanks again for listening, and we hope to see you next time at North Star Church.